What is redaction criticism? Well, we need to define a few things. Redaction. Redaction is the activity of redactor, okay? What's a redactor? Redactor is a synonym for editor, okay? So redaction criticism is a type of biblical study concerned with the activity of redactors. As Norman Perrin says in his book, What is Redaction Criticism, page 1, redaction criticism is concerned with studying the theological motivation of an author, as this is revealed in the collection, arrangement, editing, and modification of traditional material, and in the composition of new material or the creation of new forms within the traditions of early Christianity. Well, that's a quick sketch of it. We want to sketch a little of the history of redaction criticism. We want to look at the activity of redactors here in the biblical text, and especially in the Synoptic Gospels. Well, redaction criticism is a relatively recent development in liberal New Testament criticism, for which we give a kind of a quick review here. Starting with the synoptic problem and source criticism. Since the second century, there's been debate and discussion regarding the similarities and differences among the Gospels and how to explain them. By the late 19th century, a sort of consensus had been reached called the two-document theory. And this type of work, trying to figure out what the sources are, is called literary or source criticism. Next comes the historical reliability of the Gospels. This discussion of historical reliability went on in parallel to that of the synoptic problem. It became an especially sharp debate with the rise of theological liberalism in the 19th century. By the end of that century, most liberals felt that Mark was the most reliable gospel, and except for miracles, basically historical. Wilhelm Vrede, in his book Messianic Secret, 1901, argued that Mark was not reliable history, but theologically motivated to present Jesus as Messiah, though Jesus never claimed to be such. The debate on historical reliability lies behind redaction criticism as well. Form criticism does well. Form criticism arose in New Testament studies just after World War I in Germany. Its pioneers were Carl Schmitt, Martin Debailius, and especially Rudolf Bultmann. They accepted Vrede's claim that Mark made up his own framework, and they tried to go behind the Gospels to study the period of oral transmission. Most form critics claimed that between Jesus' life and the writing of the Gospels, much material was invented and much was changed. That brings us to redaction criticism. Redaction criticism seeks to round out the critical analysis of the Gospels by filling in areas overlooked by form criticism and source criticism. It studies the work of the Gospel editors, especially their theological motivation, in compiling oral materials to form written accounts, or in combining and editing written materials to form the Gospels. Redaction criticism was foreshadowed in the work of Vrede, Bultmann, and especially in R.H. Lightfoot's Bampton Lectures of 1934. But the real flowering came from Germany just after World War II, when Günter Bornkamm published material he had done on redaction criticism in Matthew, starting in 1948. Hans Conselman did the same with Luke in 1954, and then Philly Markson with Mark in 1956. More recently, redaction criticism has spread to the study of Q, the alleged source behind Matthew and Luke, and to John. Robert Gundry's work, Matthew, A Commentary on His Literary and Theological Arts, published in 1982, represents the spread of this method into evangelical circles, for which he was at one point voted out of the Evangelical Theological Society. Gundry feels that Matthew invented some of the incidents in his gospel to make theological points, i.e. the visit of the Magi and the killing of the babies. Gundry may be the most radical evangelical here, but he's certainly not alone. Methods of redaction criticism. How does redaction criticism operate? The following steps give a sketch of the procedures involved. First of all, One selects a gospel or document, say Q or M or L or Proto-Mark or Matthew or Mark or Luke or John, for study, okay? Then you carefully compare the differences in your document with parallels in the other gospels or documents. Then you attempt to discover which differences are the work of the redactor of your gospel or document. How do you do that? Well, you've got to assume some particular order and relationship of gospels. And almost invariably, since the two-document theory is the dominant one today, this is going to be the two-document theory, which holds that Matthew used Mark and Q, or that Luke used Mark and Q, etc. You then have to assume that the writer has no other sources, or at least that his own contributions can be distinguished by his style. After you have then discovered which differences are the work of the redactor of your gospel, you compile statistics in order to distinguish the author by his style, you have to compile statistics on the author's style to recognize his contributions in areas where it would otherwise be uncertain. After you have then gathered these differences together, the differences that are the work of the redactor of your gospel, you need to study these detailed differences to determine the author's, the redactor's, theological motivation for introducing these differences. And this is done typically by locating texts which express these motivations, and then to interpret the whole gospel in terms of these motivations. Lastly, one tries to reconstruct the redactor's outlook, circumstances, group, and audience, that is, his life setting or Sitzum Leben. Markson is rather typical in seeing three life settings in a given gospel passage, namely the life setting in the ministry of Jesus, then the life setting in the source which our redactor is using. So if it's, say, Matthew is the author we're looking at, then it would be Mark or Q, and then the background of the particular gospel writer, the redactor, so Matthew's background. So Markson would see these three sits and labels: ministry of Jesus, background of the source, background of the gospel writer. Some results of redaction criticism. In liberal circles, the result typically is that we know very little about the life of Jesus, but we can construct lots of diverse theological groups. We can reconstruct lots of diverse theological groups in early Christianity. In conservative circles, redaction criticism is much more restrained. But we're beginning to see the idea that not all narrative is historical. This shows up with Gundry in particular. For Gundry, Matthew becomes a kind of midrash, a term borrowed from rabbinic genres, in which one does an imaginative retelling of events to make a theological point. Well, I will leave you to do reading in redaction criticism on those particular areas, but attempt an evaluation of redaction criticism here. I started with a few favorable comments. The gospel writers did select materials about Jesus, which they chose to record. Presumably they also condensed this material, references to John 20's, so much material we've chosen this, etc. Luke's reference to compiling an account. Any detailed study of the gospel text is bound to produce some valuable insights. This approach does study the gospels in great detail. And thirdly, under favorable comments, the gospel writers apparently did emphasize various features about Jesus' ministry in their selection and presentation, as we may see by comparing the gospels. Matthew emphasizes Jesus as the King Messiah, coming in fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy to set up the kingdom of heaven. And we see parallels between Jesus and Israel, and we see discourses of Jesus. Mark has more emphasis on Jesus' actions, with briefer words, to answer the question, who is this man? And that's actually a theme for at least most of the first half of Mark. Mark's answer is, this man is the Messiah. He's the Son of God. Luke has an emphasis on historicity with his prologue and his eyewitness testimony to Jesus Christ. Luke shows an interest in social relationships and Gentiles and women and poor, and we see in him illustrative parables. John, emphasis on Jesus' significance, both cosmically and individually. His person is revealed in his words and miracles. More symbolism than in the other Gospels. More allegorical parables, we might call them. These emphases do give us insight into the theological concerns of the Gospel writers. However, having made those favorable comments about redaction criticism, I see also some very serious problems, and I categorize these into two big areas and then subheadings under it. Some results of redaction criticism are alarming. We see, for instance, rejection of recorded historical details. Freda, kind of predating redaction criticism but doing some of the same sort of stuff, says Jesus never claimed to be Messiah. Perrin, in his book on redaction criticism, says, we know little of Jesus. Here's what he says on page 69. That redaction criticism makes life of Jesus' research very much more difficult is, of course, immediately obvious. With the recognition that so much of the material in the Gospels must be ascribed to the theological motivation of the evangelist or of an editor of the tradition or a prophet or teacher in the early church, we must come to recognize that the words of R.H. Lightfoot were fully and absolutely justified. The Gospels do indeed yield us, quote, only a whisper of Jesus' voice, unquote. This means in practice that we must take as our starting point the assumption that the Gospels offer us directly information about the theology of the early church and not about the teaching of the historical Jesus. Pretty strong thing to say. That's Perrin. A second thing that Perrin says is that we should not base our faith on Jesus. Or page 72. The real cutting edge of the impact of redaction criticism is the fact that it raises very serious questions indeed about that which normally motivates life of Jesus research, namely life of Jesus theology. It raises above all the question as to whether the view of the historical Jesus as the locus of revelation and the central concern of Jesus' faith is in fact justifiable. That's a sample from a Norman Perrin, an example of liberal treatment, rejection of recorded historical details. But unfortunately, we also see with Gundry that there's a rejection of recorded historical details. Gundry argues in his commentary that the visit of the wise men and the flight to Egypt never happened. I won't quote that material for you, but it's found in his commentary on page 26 and 32 and 34 and 35. A second feature of what I would call alarming result is the generation of hypothesized historical details. So we've got rejection of recorded details and generation of hypothetical details. Here we have some more quotations from Perrin that I've not written down, and condensing down my library when I went into retirement, I got rid of that particular book. But on pages 38 and 39 of Perrin's book on redaction criticism, he quotes Markson on the setting of Mark, in which Markson has a totally hypothetical construction of what Mark is all about, that then reworks a lot of the statements in Mark to see them as statements about the historical background of Mark's setting rather than statements taking place in Jesus' life. Gundry does something of the same thing on the background of Matthew in pages 5 and 6 of Gundry's commentary. A third alarming result, besides the rejection of recorded details and the generation of hypothetical details, is the addition of the genre historical fiction to Scripture and to the Gospels in particular. Perrin says this on page 75, the Gospel of Mark is the prototype which others follow and is a mixture of historical reminiscence, interpreted tradition, and the free creativity of prophets and evangelists. It is, in other words, a strange mixture of history, legend, and myth. It is this fact which redaction criticism makes unmistakably clear. Gundry does a little something of the same. He's conservative compared to Perrin, and therefore much milder. Gundry calls the material Midrash or Haggadah, but compares it to modern historical novels, which combine truth and fiction. We see these remarks on page 630 to 632 of Gundry's commentary. So, some serious problems. Some results are alarming. Rejection of historical details, generation of hypothetical details, addition of the genre historical fiction. Some of the methods are suspect. We're going to categorize these suspect methods under various headings, which we'll call fallacies. Terminology is my own, but the methodological problems have also been noted by others, of whom C.S. Lewis, a professional literary critic, is a prominent example. I call the first of these the sand foundation fallacy. Why do we use that term? Well, it's the problem of building an elaborate methodology on questionable assumptions, which should be carefully re-examined when they produce such results, as we saw in the alarming results above. The idea that one builds up a big structure on a foundation that turns out not to be a solid foundation. What are these foundations? Well, for all of our redaction critics, it's the two-document theory, and there are problems with that. I've sketched those in my PowerPoint talk on the synoptic problem, and it's nothing that I discovered, although I can cross the ideas independently if you like. There are quite a number of New Testament scholars in recent years that have felt that the two-document theory is not a satisfactory treatment of the historical evidence. A second foundation that's problematical for Gundry, showing up in Gundry's material, is the total dependence of Matthew in his model on Mark and Q, when Matthew is, after all, an apostle and spent 3 years or so with Jesus in his ministry and must have had independent information then. So a sand foundation fallacy. A second fallacy I see is what I call the explanation fallacy. And this is the idea, which is very strong in certain academic fields, and it's a very strong popular idea as well, and that is any explanation is to be favored over ignorance. You've got to have an explanation for something rather than we don't know. Okay? This is a problem for both redaction criticism on the liberal side and sometimes for harmonization on the conservative side. You know, how do we harmonize the various accounts of Peter's three denials? Well, some people have gone so far as to wind up with six denials and trying to harmonize the thing. I would say, well, I can think of several ways of harmonizing this material, but I don't have a time machine. I don't know for sure how it goes together. I am satisfied from the Bible's own teaching and from evidences. One of my major teaching areas has been Christian evidences, that the Bible is what it claims to be, that Jesus is who it claims to be, and so certain things really happened, and materials in the various Gospels can be harmonized, and we can perhaps make suggestions, but we may be wrong on the particular suggestions. C.S. Lewis makes a rather interesting comment on the explanation fallacy in a essay he has in the collection of Lewis materials edited by Walter Hooper entitled On Stories and Other Essays on Literature. One of these is a rather nice paper called On Criticism, not a complete paper. Lewis was not finished with it when he passed away. Starts on page 127 of this particular collection and runs to about page 142 or thereabouts. On pages 132 and 133, Lewis has this to say. His basic idea in this thing is, what can we learn from lessons about from the way literary critics behave about how this relates to the Gospels? He says, I now turn to something which interests me much more because the bottom sin I detect in the reviewers is one which I believe we shall all find very difficult to banish from our own critical work. Nearly all critics are prone to imagine that they know a great many facts relevant to a book, which in reality they don't know. The author inevitably perceives their ignorance, because he, often he alone, knows the real facts. His critical vice may take many different forms. And Lewis is basically saying, here's some things I have learned about literary criticism by being not only a literary critic, but by being an author and by having literary criticism of my own works, etc. First of all, he says, of the many different forms, nearly all reviewers assume that your books were written in the same order in which they're published, and all shortly before publication. And then he gives an example of that regarding the Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Most critics assumed it must be a political allegory, and many thought the Master Ring must be the atomic bomb, etc. And he said, if you knew the history of Tolkien's writing The Lord of the Rings, you'd know that he had the basic plot structure and a good deal of the details put together even before he wrote The Hobbit in the late 30s, and long before any layman knew anything about the atomic bomb. Now, of course, nobody blames the critics for not knowing these things. How should they? The trouble is, they don't know they don't know. A guess leaps into their mind, and they write it down without even noticing it's a guess. Here, certainly, the warning to all of us as critics is very clear and alarming. Critics of Piers Plowman and the Fairy Queen make gigantic constructions about the history of their compositions. Of course, we should all admit such constructions to be conjectural, and as conjectures, we may ask, are they not some of them probable? Perhaps they are. But the experience of being reviewed has lowered my estimate of their probability. Because when you start by knowing the facts, you find that the constructions are often wholly wrong. Apparently, the chances of their being right are low, even when they're made along quite sensible lines. Well, we'll stop with that. There's some other material there. But that's the problem with the explanation fallacy. Frankly, it is better not to know the answer and know that we don't know than to know the wrong answer. I call the third fallacy the dissertation fallacy. The PhD industry drives this problem. For a PhD candidate to write a dissertation, he needs something new and academic. And when you're working with something like the Gospels, which have been around for nearly 2,000 years, and which have been worked on by New Testament scholars now for at least a couple hundred, trying to find something new and academic in the Gospels can lead to, one, rejecting a straightforward explanation for an involved explanation. Two, rejecting recorded history for reconstructed history. Three, rejecting direct evidence for indirect evidence. The result, a new sort of allegorizing. We see an excellent example of this on page 42 in Perrin. But as I mentioned, I don't have my copy of Perrin anymore here. Response of Lewis on page 140 and 141 is quite good here. Where the critic seems to me most often to go wrong is in the hasty assumption of an allegorical sense. And as reviewers make this mistake about contemporary works, so in my opinion, scholars now often make it about old ones. I would recommend both, and I would try to observe in my own critical practice, these principles. First, that no story can be devised by the wit of man, which cannot be interpreted allegorically by the wit of some other man. The Stoic interpretations of primitive mythology, the Christian interpretation of the Old Testament, the medieval interpretations of the classics, Greco-Roman classics, all prove this. Therefore, too, the mere fact that you can allegorize the work before you is of itself no proof that it's an allegory. Of course you can allegorize it. You can allegorize anything, whether in art or real life. I think we should here take a hint from the lawyers. A man is not tried at the assizes until there has been shown to be a prima facie case against him. We ought not to proceed to allegorize any work until we have plainly set out the reasons for regarding it as an allegory at all. So, the dissertation fallacy. The argument from silence fallacy. If a particular incident or detail appears in only one gospel, the writer must have invented it rather than having had additional information. Here, Lewis addresses that on page 131. Negative statements are, of course, particularly dangerous for the lazy or hurried reviewer. And here at once is a lesson for us all as critics. One passage of the whole Fairy Queen will justify you in saying that Spencer sometimes does so-and-so. Only an exhaustive reading and an unerring memory will justify the statement that he never does so. This everyone sees. What more easily escapes one is the concealed negative in statements apparently positive. For example, in any statement that contains a predicate new, one says lightly that something which Dunn or Stern or Hopkins did was new, thus committing himself to the negative that no one had done it before. But this is beyond one's knowledge. Taken rigorously, it's beyond anyone's knowledge. Argument from silence fallacy. The psychoanalytic fallacy. The critic can infer the author's motivation from his writing. Differences between the Gospels are tendentious rather than accidental, or matters of emphasis. Here again, Lewis has a rather helpful remark there. Page 134. Another type of critic who speculates about the genesis of your book is the amateur psychologist. He has a Freudian theory of literature, claims to know all about your inhibitions. He knows what unacknowledged wishes you are gratifying. And here, of course, one cannot, in the same sense as before, claim to start by knowing all the facts. By definition, you are unconscious of the things he professes to discover. Therefore, the more loudly you disclaim them, the more right he must be, though, oddly enough, if you admitted them, that would prove him right, too. And there is a further difficulty. One is here, not here so free from bias, for this procedure is almost entirely confined to hostile reviewers. And now I come to think of it, I have seldom seen it practiced on a dead author, except by a scholar who intended in some measure to debunk him. That in itself is perhaps significant, and it would not be unreasonable to point out that the evidence on which such amateur psychologists base their diagnosis would not be thought sufficient by a professional. They have not had their author on the sofa, nor heard his dreams, and had the whole case history. But I'm here concerned only with what the author can say about such reviews, solely because he is the author. And surely, however ignorant he is of his unconscious, he knows something more than they about the content of his conscious mind, and he will find them wholly overlooking the to him perfectly obvious conscious motive for some things. If they mentioned this and then discounted it as the author's or patient's rationalization, they might be right, but it's clear they never thought of it. They have never seen why, from the very structure of your story, from the very nature of storytelling in general, that episode or image or something like it had to come in at that point. It is, in fact, quite clear that there's one impulse in your mind of which, with all their psychology, they have never reckoned, the plastic impulse, the impulse to make a thing, to shape, to give unity, relief, contrast, pattern. But this, unhappily, is the impulse which chiefly caused the book to be written at all. They have clearly no such impulse themselves, and they do not suspect it in others, etc. They seem to fancy that a book trickles out of one like a socket or a tear or automatic writing. It may well be that there is much in every book which comes from the unconscious, but when it is your own book, you know the conscious motives as well. You may be wrong in thinking that these give the full explanation of this or that, but you can hardly believe accounts of the sea bottom given by those who are blind to the most obvious objects on the surface. They could be right only by accident, and I, if I attempt any similar diagnosis about the dead, shall equally be right, if at all, only by accident. We give one last fallacy here, the intellectual snobbery fallacy. As humans, fallen humans, we all tend to envy those people who have more prestige. And in the academic area, that's those that have university degrees, have PhDs and such. And in this particular case, that would be university liberals. And we all tend to look down on those with less prestige. And that would be conservatives, who have generally not had as much success in getting university positions, and not all of which is due to abilities. That is something we have to watch out for. Well, some serious problems with redaction criticism. Some of the results are alarming. And when results are alarming, they should lead us at least to look at methodology. And we suggest that the methods are suspect. Sam's foundation fallacy, the explanation fallacy, the dissertation fallacy argument from silence fallacy, psychoanalytic fallacy, intellectual snobbery fallacy. Conclusions on redaction criticism. I'm not trying to give an argument for anti-intellectualism. Rather, I'm trying to call for a sober assessment of our own abilities and for fear of God. God is the one, after all, we see in 1 Corinthians 3:19, who takes the wise in their craftiness, and as we see in Proverbs 21:30, against whom there is no wisdom, nor understanding, nor counsel. If it turns out that we, by fallacious methods, have talked ourselves out of the truth, we will have no one to blame but ourselves when we face the consequences of that. We are to love God with all our mind. Rather, I'm calling us for a sober assessment of human abilities and for fear of God. May the Lord help us to have these things as we examine the whole question of how we are to understand the materials that God has given us in the New Testament and in the Gospels in particular. Well, that's the end of our two-part discussion on form criticism and redaction criticism. I ask that may we handle God's Word with reverence and fear.